Well, Pat Wright and David Rainey went to Bolivia at the end of August. I can remember when it was because I had really wanted to go with them. Pat had mentioned something, but it was the same week I went to Denver. And so this is my little Bolivia trip now. Having them come here, I met them in Washington Island. And a couple years ago, when I was up there painting, I was painting some children from Venezuela, and Pat overheard me, and she told me she'd just been to Venezuela the year before. They'd done a lot of traveling. And Pat Wright is a former director at the University of Illinois Chicago Voorhees Center for Neighborhood and Community Improvement, and the co-author of the recent book, Where Are Poor People to Live? And David Rainey is Professor Emeritus at the Urban Planning and Policy Department at the University of Illinois Chicago. He is former director of UIC Center for Urban Economic Development, the author of the book Global Decisions, Local Collisions, Urban Life and the New World Order. Has been an activist in the Alliance for Responsible Trade for the past 15 years.
Well, thank you everyone for coming out, and thanks so much for bringing such great food. And thank you to Mary for setting all this up. Really a pleasure to do this. Many people asked us what in the world Pat and I were doing going to Bolivia in the midst of a presidential election when the economy is collapsing and there's two wars in the Middle East. And the reason is that both of us very much believe that there's something very important going on in South America that we want to learn about, and really something that our government is not only not helping, but is attempting to undermine. And so one of the things we want to talk with you about is U.S. foreign policy. Hopefully in the next week or so we'll have look forward to the opportunity of having some something new going on in Washington. But I think it's up to those of us that are informed to try to influence the direction of that, because it's not clear at this moment where Senator Obama stands on some of the issues that we're going to raise tonight. We are particularly interested in some of the things in South America because there's some very interesting experimentation going on with economic development and community development initiatives that touch our own former professional interests. Pat being a real expert in affordable housing, myself being involved in trying to promote living wage employment in Chicago, and also being involved with groups from particularly Mexico and Canada in developing alternatives to the proposal for a North American Free Trade Agreement and policies that stem from there. I'm going to begin with some observations based on our trips, mainly our trip to Bolivia, but also to some extent Venezuela. And then Pat is going to talk in some more detail about a specific aspect of what we did there, that is to look at housing. I mean, what we did, we'll go through the trip with you briefly, but what we did is, this wasn't a tourist trip. We had a guide, we had six other people with us, and we went around and talked to people who were involved with human rights, with community development, housing specialists, like people from Habitat for Humanity, and people who were involved in various forms of economic development, and also some political figures as well. We went at a time when Bolivia was in a tremendous state of uproar, if you will. Evo Morales had been challenged by the right wing in his country, and they forced upon him a recall election after 2.5 years in office. When he was elected to office, he had 54% majority, certainly far better than George Bush ever did. But when he faced the recall election, he won that time by 67% of the vote. So he has tremendous support in his own country. However, there's a very wealthy and very well-connected to the United States and well-connected in financial circles around the world, a minority of 10% who are making a lot of noise, who have formed a youth militia of brown shirts. They wear brown shirts. They are proud to be called brown shirts. They are come out of the Falangist Party, which was Franco's party in Spain, as well as the Nazi Party in Germany, the Croatian Party after World War II. You know, this is the origins of many of these people, and also after the collapse of the Soviet Union, some of the worst elements of Soviet communism also came to Bolivia. Klaus Barbie came to Bolivia after World War II, so there's that element. And they have launched sometimes very violent resistance to the government. We arrived on the day of the general strike in the heart of their territory. We'll talk about that in a moment. But I think the one message that we try to give to everyone that we talk to is that oftentimes in the U.S. media, and certainly from the U.S. government, it's said that the governments in Bolivia and also Venezuela are dictatorships, that their leaders are tyrants. And, you know, I can tell you from personal experience that these are not dictatorships. They are about as open democratic governments as I could possibly imagine, and frankly more democratic than we are here in the United States. There is a completely free press. There is the usual kind of separation of powers. There's an elected president. There's a constitution. You know, and it's real. It hasn't been in existence very long in those countries, but it is real. Second observation concerns a view expressed by many in this country that the governments of South America, and particularly Bolivia and Venezuela, are anti-American and are left-wing. There are considerable negative feelings toward the Bush administration in South America. There are in the United States, too. But nonetheless, we did not find people, certainly didn't find people anti-American in any way. They wished us well. They wished that we'd get rid of George Bush. And the reason being that the Bush administration, but also, sadly, the Clinton administration, have done a lot of things that they consider quite negative in their country. And furthermore, what is uniting the peoples of South America is not ideology. And this is a real misconception. Each of the countries that has voted in an independent government, each of those countries is doing things in a slightly different way. You could put them on a spectrum from left to right, but I don't think that's particularly useful. I think they have democratic governments going in all of the countries, really, of South America now, and most of them are united about one thing, and that is a rejection of the policies that they call neoliberalism, that have often been called the Washington Consensus, that are the quid pro quo that the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and the Latin American Development Bank forced upon them in order to get loans at a time when their economies were in desperate straits in the 1980s. And in every single case, those policies, which uniformly involved a period of what they call orthodox shock, very tight money policies with high interest rates, forcing the government to balance its budget, devaluating their currency, and decreasing government spending in order to balance the budget, followed by structural adjustment programs that involve privatization of water, of gas, public utilities that cause people's costs to go up, increasing imports by reduction of tariffs and producing goods for export to have a favorable balance of trade, which meant shifting away from a focus on food security for their own people to a program of exporting food to other countries, which often meant switching to grains to feed cattle, often exporting, say, from Bolivia to Argentina cattle feed, and then the beef gets exported to the United States, that kind of thing. These policies really were the other end of the very same policies, in my opinion, that brought us the financial meltdown and are bringing us the recession today. They emphasized the flow of capital, the mobility of capital that could go very easily out of this country and into other countries and back again. The trading of debt, you know, was a key aspect of this. It greatly increased the amount of debt to the developing world, and then when they couldn't pay, there was more debt and these policies that hurt the average person. In response, a series of presidents throughout South America pledged to resist these policies, to come up with alternatives, and they also pledged to reduce poverty and, to coin a phrase, to spread the wealth around a little bit. We've heard that one, right? South American nations on that common ground are attempting to create some of their own institutions on a regional basis, and this is something that we were particularly interested in. They are attempting to take the vision that was originally put forward by Simón Bolívar in the 1830s, which failed, to have a United States of South America. And to that end, they have created four institutions that are very fragile, that are in their very early stages of development. There is a Bank of the South that attempts to be a development bank to replace the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the Latin American Development Bank, a development bank that would be based on their own vision of development and how they want things to go, not on external visions of development and one-size-fits-all economic policies. They have developed another organization called the Bolivarian Alternative Trade Agreement. That is an association of nations to engage in trade with one another, but trade on their own terms, trade the kind of trade that will benefit their own countries and not some other country. Thirdly, they have a television station, Telesur, a satellite station kind of on the model of Al Jazeera, to project a South American point of view. And this is in competition with Fox News and CNN, whose Spanish versions blare 24 hours a day throughout South America. They're attempting to compete with that. And finally, there's UNASUR. UNASUR would like to become a parliament for South America based on the model of the European Union. These are, as I say, in their infancy. We don't know how well they're ultimately going to do. But in my opinion, it's a very exciting development because it's really a first step of economic development that has the potential to benefit many people who are now being left out in South America. The U.S., of course, installed the policies I'm talking about initially in Chile in 1973. Where in the aftermath of a CIA-financed coup against Salvador Allende, the group of economists trained at the University of Chicago, known as the Chicago Boys, under the tutelage of Milton Friedman, brought their economic policies and plans to Chile. That was really the first instance in which these policies surfaced. And then, as I mentioned, the next phase was the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. During the 1990s and during the last 8 years of the Bush administration, there has been this unity against those policies and a real backlash and an effort to create alternatives. The response of the U.S. government has been to fund opposition groups who are friendly to these policies and to help them destabilize and topple these governments, particularly in Venezuela and in Bolivia. This has occurred. In Venezuela, I think many of you may know that there was an actual coup against President Chavez. This is why he's so mad at George Bush. I mean, they went into his office and arrested him, and we helped fund it. But you know, the interesting thing was that the army decided, there are many people in the streets protesting, that the army decided that they would uphold the constitution of the country and said that this coup was over, and Chavez was released from captivity and went back to being president again. We had immediately recognized the legitimacy of the new government before they had Chavez completely locked up, and he got out, and he's back in power and angry. In Bolivia, about a week after we were there, Evo Morales kicked out the U.S. ambassador, Philip Goldberg, for collaborating with the opposition. We know that the National Endowment for Democracy, a taxpayer-supported U.S. organization controlled pretty much by the State Department, has been given funding. They're a public organization. You can go on their website and see who they've been funding. They've been giving a great deal of funding to Bolivia and not to the institutions and the people we've talked with, but to the opposition. The State Department has been giving quite a bit of money to Bolivia. There's been efforts to try to get them under Freedom of Information Act to say who they're funding, and they won't tell. But, you know, I think while there's no smoking gun there, it's pretty clear. There's also been efforts throughout South America, and including Bolivia, to create a military presence. This is done usually, except in Colombia, where it's done overtly, it's done under the guise of the war on drugs or the war on terror. In Bolivia, the U.S. has completely funded and equipped a special forces unit of the Bolivian Army that is charged with stopping cocaine traffic out of Bolivia. But in reality, they are moles within the military, and it's a very difficult situation. I want to tell you a few more things just about the country. I think while there are these efforts at collective behavior, creating these four institutions I mentioned, it's really important to know that every country has its own particularities, its own internal politics. You can't treat South America as if it's one thing. Each place is different. Venezuela and Bolivia are very different places. We've been in Peru. Peru is very different from either one of them. And we've been in Ecuador briefly, so is that. And I've been to Chile. All these places have very, very different politics as a result of having different conditions. Bolivia is a very small country of only 10 million people, about the size of metropolitan Chicago in terms of population. In terms of area size, it's fairly large. It's large if you took Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, and Michigan, and Lake Michigan, and put them all together. That would be about the physical size of the country. I guess people probably know where Bolivia is. It's sort of in the middle there of South America. The climate varies from very tropical in the east, because in the east, that dark green area is known as the Media Luna, the half moon. Each of those names is a state, or they call them department of Bolivia. That in this area, in the dark green, this border of Brazil and inward is all the Amazon basin. It has a climate similar to the state of Florida. But as you move west, as you get to say Cochabamba, where we visited, see, we were in Santa Cruz, and then we were in Cochabamba. When you get in there, you're in the foothills of the Andes Mountains. It's about 10,000 feet. It's cooler there. They have a shorter growing season. There's some valleys where certain crops can grow. But then when you get as far as La Paz over here, and right up above La Paz, another city that's not on the map called El Alto, which was the fourth city we went to. La Paz is about at 13,000 feet. El Alto is another 1,000 feet straight up. So they're up very, very high. So you have quite a varied population. Agriculture in the east is mostly soybeans, but the land distribution, you know, they have the capacity to feed people in Bolivia in the east, but the land distribution is one of the worst in the world. 0.6% of the population owns 2/3 of the land that's arable. Now that's a very difficult situation. The other thing is that these landholders are uniformly white. 60% of the population is Indian, 10% is white, the rest, the other 30%, are mestizo, mixed race people. And there's considerable vying for the loyalty of the mestizos on both sides. So the 10% minority is able to get some of the mestizos onto their side. This situation means that these landholders, who are often granted lands under previous dictatorships, the former mining oligarchs own a great deal of land. The Croatians have a lot of land. Former Soviet Union people that left when the wall fell, they're not communists, they're fascists in reality, that their sympathies are that way. They own this land and they keep most of it fallow. There's provision in the Bolivian constitution that if land is fallow for so long, the government has a right to take that land, what we would say by eminent domain, meaning you take the land and you pay them a fair market price for it. They don't want that to happen, and they don't want that to happen for a very simple reason, and it is that the workers who work that land are Indians, and the Indians have very little land of their own, and if there was a major redistribution of land in Bolivia, that would mean that their cheap labor would have an alternative and would not be available to them to farm that land. And that's a very, very critical part of the politics of what's going on right now. On the one side, these large landholders. On the other side, the Evo Morales administration and his Indian supporters, who not only want to give the Indians a way to get out of poverty, but are also concerned with food security. So that this is a very key thing. The other thing is that the hydrocarbons, which is largely natural gas and oil, but mostly natural gas, is largely produced in an area. Where is that arrow? Kind of around in here, and down in these areas here. This is where most of it is, kind of near the border of Paraguay there. And the importance of that is that the main source of wealth and income in Bolivia right now is the revenues from these hydrocarbons. These have gone from being almost completely in private hands to being semi-nationalized. Evo Morales, when he took office, did what he called nationalizing the gas industry. But it's not what we would think of as nationalization. What he did is he negotiated with the foreign oil companies a higher percentage of the take, a much higher percentage of the take. They were getting 54%, it went up to 85%. This was a real shot in the arm in terms of revenues. But the other aspect of this is that there are no taxes of any sort in Bolivia. And there's small sales tax. It's nothing. but there's not a property tax at the local level. There's not a broad-based income tax. So all of the revenues that are run by, that are needed by government, by the universities, there's not private universities, they're public universities, by the government, by the universities, by the municipalities, by the police, which are all national, by the military, come from gas and oil, and some from minerals such as tin, but mostly gas. So this is critical. So that there's a tremendous struggle over the distribution of those. Now, it's beyond the scope of tonight to try to explain to you how they are distributed. It's the most head-bending formula you could ever imagine. But what happens essentially is that the state gas company collects all the revenues and delves it out, gives the 15% to the foreign companies, that's their share, and then delves the rest of it out by this formula to different entities. The governors of each state, which they call the prefectures, get a certain percentage of it. The municipalities get a percentage of it. The federal government gets a percentage of it. It's spread around like that. What Evo Morales did is that because of the increase in the price of gas, where there are more revenues, and because of the higher percentage of take that his government got, there was a lot more to go around. So without actually cutting the amount to anybody, he reduced the percentage that the governors got and took it and used it to create two new programs in Bolivia right off the bat. This was very controversial. One was Social Security. The elderly had no means of living, and in a country with a high poverty rate, which I'll get to in a moment, this was a very important program. The other was that he gave a stipend to youth who finished high school. Each year, for 4 years, they get a certain amount of money. It's not a huge amount of money, but it's an incentive to go to school. So it's meant as an incentive for education and part of the education program. The governors of the states, particularly in the dark green here, went nuts. But they used it as an excuse, if you will, to launch a campaign against the government, that they took illegally this money. The government is attempting to change the Constitution in a way that would solidify this and the land distribution in the Constitution itself. There has been a draft constitution that has been developed by a constituent assembly through debate and discussion and voted on. The entire constitution will go to the voters in January for an up or down approval. If it's approved by a majority of Bolivians, it goes into effect. Poverty is, of course, the most essential issue here. Poverty is at a level of 60%. 60% of Bolivians live below the poverty line. Another, within that 60%, 34% of the entire population of Bolivia are in what they call extreme poverty, which means many are starving, or at least are hungry most of the time. It means they may be homeless or have shelter that has no access to water, sewage, or electricity. It means they're ill-clothed. This is the most dire problem that the country faces. The three issues that I think are important are the hydrocarbon issue, the land issue, and race and human rights. The racism on the part of the whites and the mestizo minority is as thick as it was in the south of the United States before the civil rights movement here. There's violence against Indians on a constant basis. Okay, within that context, I'm going to very quickly run through what we did, and then I'm going to turn it over to Pat. We were in Santa Cruz, Cochabamba. You can see the foothills of the Andes here. La Paz, 13,000 feet, and up on those mountaintops is El Alto, okay? What are those towers? Those are radio towers. This says, as is known, the Aymara man, the Aymara is one of the Indian tribes, is better than the system. Kind of like that sign. But I should have said that there are actually 37 different Indian tribes, each with a separate language and a separate governance structure. There are two major ones, which are the Aymara and the Quechua. And Morales has been successful in uniting those groups.
And he's an Aymara Indian.
He's an Aymara.
That's another picture of El Alto.
Yeah. El Alto. This is the Amazon basin. These are the hills around Cochabamba. These are the Andes from the air. This is what the right-wing movement that we walked into when we arrived at the airport. A general strike was on. Our taxi driver had to have a special tag to get through barricades that they put up across each street that were guarded by brown-shirted youths with baseball bats. And we were a bit apprehensive, but this says we are autonomous, Crucianos, power, we're making history. Crucianos means the people who live in Santa Cruz. This is what the brown shirts looked like. Somebody's crossed out communism and wrote fascism in its place. FSB is for the Falange Socialist Party of Bolivia. This was the people that identify with the Franco's old party in Spain. That's what kept us from getting the tar beat out of us when we went through the barricades in the cab. They gave them this pass. And these are some signs on the other end for... these are signs for autonomy, I'm sorry. This is a sign on the other end for Evo Morales, Evo C. This is the banner of Evo Morales' party, the MAS, Movement Towards Socialism. Note the icon of Che Guevara in the corner, who was killed in Bolivia. This is supporting the Social Security program that I mentioned. This is supporting the recall, supporting Evo in the recall election of Alvaro as the vice president. Oops. This is a graffiti in favor of the youth program that I mentioned. There's Evo. This is, we visit a lot of houses. Pat's going to talk about them. This particular one was Habitat for Humanity. If you're familiar with them, you'll notice their logo on the house. We met with the housing minister of Bolivia, comparable to the Secretary of HUD here in the United States. There he is. Wonderful person. Pat will talk about him. This was an NGO, a non-governmental organization, that's a coalition of housing organizations attempting to develop affordable housing. This is a human rights worker in Santa Cruz who said she feared for her life. Her office was firebombed and burned to the ground by the right wing. This is Domitila Chungara, very famous woman in Bolivia who organized all of the wives of miners in the 1970s, became a major labor leader. She wrote a book called Let Me Speak. It was one of the first-person narratives that talked about the interplay of gender oppression with class oppression and the very delicate balance. She was personally abused by her husband, but also arrested and very badly tortured by the government during that period. She prevailed over the government. She dumped her husband, and she's now has a school for organizers, an absolutely wonderful woman. That's me and our guide with Domitila's book. This was a meeting of peasants that we went to who were organizing to protest the fact that they had no sewage and water hookups in their homes. And this is the organizer, the guy in the black, working with them, who invited us to their meeting. This is a particularly wonderful place known as El Trono. El Trono is began as a program to eliminate drug use among youth. They used the theater to do so, began to teach theater. They built this building, which is a 5-story building that includes a theater and many rooms to do virtually all the performing arts, theater, dance, traditional music, making of mass and traditional art, and also circus arts among youth. They have become a very large organization. That entire building was built with recycled materials, and it's amazing, amazing place. That's the director of it that we met with, probably one of the greatest youth workers I've ever met in my life. There's the women practicing dance. And then this teenage girl was telling us about the program they have, where they have many of these children, most of them, are the sons and daughters of miners who, when they were displaced from the mines, moved to El Alto. So they've reconstructed a mine in the basement of this building. And they do performance art, if you will. They get the kids to go down into mine shafts that were recreated there and reenact some of the greatest moments in the history of the miners' labor movement, and thereby learning about who their parents are and what their own heritage is. It was quite an inspiring place. And by the way, when we told these young girls that we had met with Domitila, their eyes got big as saucers, because she was really their heroine. This is a woman named Leonilda Zurita, the one at the end of the table. She's a senator. She's the head of the Women's Peasant Association. Seated to her right is a woman named Apollonia, who is the vice minister in the Ministry of Justice, dealing with women's rights and with the rights of the elderly. Neolida Zurita, many people in Bolivia believe, and we could believe it when we met her, may well be the next president of Bolivia after Evo's term runs out. Magnificent person. So remember that face. That's her with Evo Morales and her husband. Her husband, by the way, drove us around. We had really good access here. And now I'm going to turn over to Pat, talk a little bit about housing.
Yes, we spent a great deal of time visiting housing groups, and I'll just go through. I want to just give you an idea of some of the housing facts and some pictures of the kind of housing that people have down there. What's interesting in Bolivia is most of the people build their own homes. The emphasis in Bolivia is on self-help and home ownership, but they really, and the community groups, the NGOs that we met with, did a number of variety of services to help people in building their homes and also in getting total ownership. Because one of the major problems is that they don't have title to the land. There isn't squatting in Bolivia as in many other South American countries. What does happen is oftentimes they have an agreement to build on a piece of property without all the, you know, all of the legal documents. So that has become an issue in terms of trying to get better records, etc., about property. And then, of course, the big thing is, even though you have, you know, 57% home ownership, often, you know, these are homes that have no water and no sewer connections. And so that is something in that meeting that we showed previously, is many of they're working on improving the water quality and also just making sure that they do have sewer connections. And the groups we met with worked on a number of things. And also, as part of the Constitution, they want housing to be a human right and written into the Constitution. But we worked with, this is one of the groups that we met with, and RED means network habitat. Habitat for Humanity is part of this network, but there were several other groups that we met with that all were working mostly on home ownership and home improvement. Habitat for Humanity has a very strong presence in Bolivia, and we visited many of their sites. This is just giving you an idea of sort of a typical neighborhood in La Paz. And all of these homes, many of these homes, the community groups weren't working with some of these, most of these homes that are built on the side of the mountains because they consider them unstable. Because we were there during the winter, but in rainy season, many of these homes are, you know, end up sliding down the mountains, unfortunately. But you see the infrastructure. This is all La Paz that I'm showing you now, which is, of course, you know, in the mountain areas. But you have these intricate sidewalk connections to connect everybody. This family that we visited had built their own home, and the community group that we were visiting with helped them improve it and make it a larger facility, the wings on the side. And likewise, this is another. This is also in El Alto, the city above La Paz, but it gives you an idea of the construction. They use a lot of masonry and adobe. This family we visited with, this woman had 9 children. Her husband was a mason. She had 4 jobs to support her children, and they had built this home themselves. It had numerous, there was like 3 or 4 small buildings that were all different bedrooms for her kids, and then one room was where they did the cooking, etc. This is the outside of the house where you can see that she had a small store also. This is the house that we were in, but, and she had a small store that she got, was one of her sources of income. But as you can see, this is looking down the street from her house, and there's very poor infrastructure.
That's the school.
And that's the local school that right here. A lot of the families, this is another family that built their own homes. They make money by renting out rooms to people who don't, family and other people that don't have their homes. They also, this community group, they're into micro-enterprise. They had helped them buy that van, and there is no public transportation in La Paz in El Alto. So people buy private vans and then charge people to drive them to work in different places. Now we've gone to the Amazon Basin. This is the development that Habitat for Humanity had put up in Santa Cruz, which is in the tropical area. They had a number of developments, and they are putting in septic systems as part of these homes. They're very small. These homes are less than 500 square feet. So they're nicely built, high ceilings, but the rooms, the square footage is very small on these homes. Now, this is a government project, and as you can see, these are even smaller homes that the government is financing. It's home ownership, but they get small loans that they pay over a long term to pay for these homes. This is a development for vendors, even vendors who sell off push carts, so that's why the homes are a lot smaller. And as you can see, they have tin roofs versus the Habitat had clay roofs. This is another Habitat development that we went to. And people could improvise and add on. Like this one was one of my favorites. The gentleman that you can see in the is tiling his own house there. It's all this beautiful white tile, and he had added on this porch on his own. These are some of his neighbors. This is in Cochabamba. This was a very interesting group of women who had organized themselves. Women who had experienced domestic violence had organized a large collective. We met with them, where strictly the women were the owners of the property. This is the organizer and leader of this group. It was quite a large development. They had very strict rules of women, and they could obviously remarry again if they wanted to, but if anything, if there was any kind of divorce or separation, the women had the right to the house, to stay with the children. And this is all that development that's in Cochabamba, built on the foothills. This is just we have some statistics that we can share with you. So we'll just open it up for questions. We have a lot more information on housing and also some of the issues that Dave raised, but at this point, why don't we just open it up?
You said the poverty rate in Bolivia was 60%. Is that 60% absolute, like less than $2 a day poverty?
Well, it means The specific amount is I think
$30 a month.
$30 a month is what it is.
But to give you an idea, like the Habitat for Humanity builds those homes for teachers and policemen, and they make $100 a month. But they could afford those homes, which we're selling at $6,000, is what the cost of those homes would be. But that's with the people building a lot of it themselves. But it gives you an idea of even professionals don't make that much money. $100 a month. Teachers, policemen, factory workers.
What's the fertility rate in population growth rate?
It's not...
You have it
somewhere. I do have it somewhere. It's not that high. I do have the infant mortality rate, which is 6 for kids less under 5 years, 1,000, but per 1,000 births would be 65 per 1,000 live births under 5 is the infant mortality rate. That's pretty high. Another similar statistic is that 23% are undernourished, you know, which is another. The woman that has the 9 kids, we asked her about education for the children. The children are all working in the informal sector, too. They're shining shoes, they're doing all kinds of things. And she said that she did not think her children would be able to learn in school because they were so badly malnourished, which is really something. Yeah.
What's the birth rate like?
The birth rate? I better look that up. It's not very high.
It's not real high.
It's not real high.
But it is a very Catholic country.
Yeah. Well, I know.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that two things that Morales has done, it sounds like a very creative one, Social Security, quickest way to bring the birth rate down. Second is the educational system.
Yeah.
Social Security, you know, like in Africa, you have to have 15 children to support you, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do want to make, I'll call on Dan in a second, but I want to make one observation about this, though. I think one of the biggest problems that the government has, if they can just get rid of the U.S. and the right wing, is that they've taken power in a situation where this is the first time Indians have ever been in power. There are not... Education is a problem because there's not a lot of trained professionals who aren't on the other side. So they can't really trust many of the trained people. And that's a tremendous dilemma. They are getting some technical assistance from friendly people on the outside. The housing minister was a person that had, you know, really for some reason or other was able to get himself trained as an architect in Brazil and was there in the administration. But this was unusual. And, you know, we thought this was one of the more difficult problems that Morales has to face. He's a coca farmer. He's the head of the Cocalero Union. He doesn't have background for this. He doesn't have a whole bunch of advisors around him. So, you know, I thought people were being a little too impatient with him. I mean, he really is trying to develop some programs.
I have one other question, Ed. Do you know what the plan is for land redistribution at all? How the plan to be implemented? Because that's probably been the most problematic thing across the world forever.
Yeah.
They hardly ever work.
Right. I do not know what it is. I don't. Because so far, politically, it's been difficult to do it. Dan.
Is there any family planning program at all, even though it's a Catholic country?
I don't think so. But there, as part of the Constitution, they are developing a whole woman's Bill of Rights. And the two women that we met, Senator Leonilda, she has really strongly promoted this. But because of the religion, I think that is a problem. I mean, we didn't show it. I mean, I in that one picture you probably saw, she had the Last Supper up, but on the other wall she had a huge picture of the Pope. Birth control is definitely an issue with women. Although we met a lot of very strong women. Obviously, we went to that co-op that was all organized by women, and you know we met their senators, etc. But I think the whole issue of birth control is still
What is the average family size? I'm curious.
We have all these.
Because I don't think that that's the biggest problem.
It isn't.
The problem is distribution of wealth.
That and, yes. Land distribution and, frankly, food security and malnutrition. I think they're thinking of, we've seen some reports where they're looking at, a food program. To me, that was very important, was the malnutrition, which is going to affect the children because they're not getting enough to eat.
The family planning thing, though, in Catholic Europe, Catholic Europe has the lowest birth rate in the world.
Right.
In contrast to Protestant Europe. Right. So the Catholic Church, over time, with maturity and sophistication, social security, good education, is irrelevant.
Right. I agree. I think the issue is, having is the distribution of income and wealth creation.
The average, the birth rate is 4 per woman.
4?
Mm-hmm. Dan Baker, back there.
Have they always funded this government strictly on the basis of these
hydrocarbons?
And is there any move afoot to try and run things in a more expanded way? And are they the only country down there that does that?
I do not know that. I know. They do have taxes in Venezuela, and they do in Chile. But I was rather astounded by this myself. And, of course, Evo Morales is well aware that a complete dependency on gas is not a good thing for the long term. And they are having debates inside the administration about what to do about it. But on the one hand, some of his supporters are very impatient, saying, Evo hasn't done anything yet. We heard this from people that like him, but were mad at him. And I was saying, give the guy a break. He's only been in office a couple of years. I said, look what he's got to work with. But so there's that impatience. And then you've got the right wing that's saying he can't do anything. And it's very, very difficult. Yes?
What are they doing about the food shortage? What are they trying to do?
Not enough.
They're not doing enough. It is a shortage. There is a proposal before the government that my opinion, they ought to get going on to begin to grow crops that aren't dependent on those fertile grounds in the Media Luna that the right wing now controls until they can get the land distribution. That's going to take some time. And there are certain crops. Potatoes is one. It's a major source of nutrition. So potato farming, there's also some root crops. And then there's
quinoa.
We call it quinoa. You can probably get it at the co-op. It's a very, it's a grain that has a high level of protein and is very nutritious. And to grow, that can grow in the Andes to a great extent. And to subsidize that. And also to use some of the hydrocarbon revenues, not only to subsidize it, but also to bring in imports of farm machinery to increase productivity in the agriculture sector, which would help with food security. But they also have to do this land distribution thing, so it's tough. Let's hear, some people haven't talked yet. Yeah.
I'm concerned about the starvation, too. Early on, you mentioned that there were policies that favored producing food for export as opposed for the local people, and I'm wondering, what is the thinking behind that?
Oh, that's a great question. The reason is actually fairly simple. It doesn't make much sense if you're a Bolivian or a Mexican. This was done everywhere where the IMF came in. Mexico, for instance, shifted a lot of its production of corn to feed its own people to sorghum for cattle feed that could be exported. This sort of thing, the main crop in Bolivia right now is soybeans that are grown by these rich big landholders that are largely exported for cattle feed to it's a grade of soybean that is used for cattle feed and goes to Argentina and Chile. The reason is that these countries have loans from international banks and the IMF and the World Bank that they want paid back. And the only way they're going to pay them back is with export revenues. And that's the reasoning behind it. So, you know, for instance, when NAFTA was being negotiated with Mexico, I was part of a group and later a group of activists in Mexico and Canada and the U.S. We called the U.S. part the Alliance for Responsible Trade. And then that later got enlarged to include all of Latin America, something called the Hemispheric Social Alliance. That one of the main demands we made was that the priority for agriculture production in every country had to be food security. And that was our alternative, that they can't get away with that. And if they can't pay off their loan, they shouldn't have made the loan. Just like the subprime mortgage loans, they shouldn't have made those loans either.
But if the rich aren't paying taxes, they're still not going to pay off those loans.
There are no taxes, and that's true. The tax thing is tricky because the president before Evo Morales, a guy named Gonzalo de Lozada, at the bidding of the IMF, did impose an income tax. I don't know the details of what that tax was, but they were taxing poor people who had absolutely nothing. And probably, if I understood the politics right, weren't taxing the rich very much at all. But that caused such protest in Bolivia. I mean, one thing to understand is that Evo Morales came out of a social movement that was protesting first the privatization of water, what they call the water wars, and kicked Bechtel Corporation out of the country. Then they nationalized gas, and you know, most of those, you know, they did do this nationalization thing, but got it down to only 54%, and then Morales got it up to 85%. But there were huge demonstrations to get even the 54%, because it was worse before that. The third thing was the income tax. And people went nuts with the income tax. Evo Morales cannot come in there at this point in time and impose a broad-based tax, even if it's highly progressive. I mean, he frankly, I think we'd seen nothing yet if he just attempted to lay a huge tax on those rich people. They wouldn't pay it. You know, we were amazed at this. If in this country a bunch of dissidents captured O'Hare Airport, told President Bush he couldn't land there, what do you think would happen to them? At best, they'd end up in Guantanamo, right? I mean, you know, they would have come in there like hell's fire. Evo realized that going into the areas of the Media Luna and essentially retaking the rest of the country away from these people could only be done with great bloodshed. And he did not want Bolivians to be killing other Bolivians and to start a civil war. That's what they wanted him to do, and he didn't do it. Even got highly criticized by his own military. It wasn't until in the state of Pando, the right-wing not only captured the airport and refused to let anybody from the government in there, but they machine-gunned a group of Evo Morales supporters and killed 30 of them and wounded 120 before Evo finally sent troops in and retook the airport and arrested the governor. But he's shown tremendous restraint, but frankly, we're not completely sure how loyal the military is to him. And, you know, it's not completely clear. And there was mixed messages even when they went into Pando. So, so these are difficult things. They couldn't just go in there and tax the rich and expect to not do it without the military.
Did your going, your reason for going, was it to be, were you being supported in your presence there?
Yes. I mean,
it's tremendous. It was a dangerous place for you to go.
Yes, but we didn't know that when we planned the trip. I mean, it got more dangerous as we, you know, as the day grew near.
We had a little debate with our group
because there was also hurricanes. We had to fly around.
So we say, okay, we got a hurricane and a general strike, and
there were hurricanes in Bolivia.
No, in Miami, but we had to fly out of Miami.
We had to fly through Miami.
And we had to wait until one hurricane went through, and then when we were coming back 10 days later, there was another hurricane that we had to fly.
But initially, your interest was just to see for yourselves.
Yes.
I wondered if your motive in going was...
Right. And the group, we went with a small group, which was in that one picture. There was only six of us, and... You know, two of us had a housing interest in the organizer. We spent a lot of time talking to housing groups. And it was to do what we're doing now. We wanted to learn about what was going on in Bolivia ourselves, but then people were so generous in terms of, you know, showing us around and really wanting us to understand what was happening and what they were up against, that we felt an obligation to come back and talk to as many people as we could when we came back to share their story. Especially when you read in the press here, you don't hear anything about, you know, only the negative things, and it's usually pretty distorted about, you know, why the ambassador was thrown out, etc. So that's why we went.
And why
we're doing this tonight.
Yeah, I mean, we've been touring around, and we told them that when we came in that we would do this, and in appreciation for the time they gave us. We both have an interest in these kinds of things, and you know, I've been working on this since 1990 on alternatives to neoliberalism. So when you see it actually in action, you really want to talk to people about it and see how it's going.
I have a question about the racism. I was interested that it looks like with the housing that they seem, the people seem willing to expand their neighborhoods. And when I was in Venezuela, I was just struck by the water and sewer and the small houses together and how people were not going to keep being able to keep populating and live in those neighborhoods. But the message I got was that they protect themselves, and their children don't just leave the neighborhood without some sort of protection when they go down the hills into other areas. And, you know, I got the strong message they don't rely on the police, they protect their home. And they had tried leaving, and this woman gave me a lot of examples of why they just didn't want to leave their area. And I just, because I had talked to her about trying to do something like I'm looking at here. And so I'm wondering why, if there's all this racism, how come they're feeling so comfortable?
Well, one thing that was quite different than Caracas, for instance, is that La Paz and Cochabamba are pretty much Indian places. I mean, almost everybody's Indian there. It's only when you get into the east and like that place Santa Cruz where we were, and even the people who are white didn't look real white. To me, I mean, I think white was more of an identity rather than racial. I mean, it was how people identified themselves, how they dressed, the language they used. People in Indian dress in that part of the country were very vulnerable, and people were beaten just on the streets for no reason at all, and they were wearing their traditional garments. But when you get to El Alto, it's the exact opposite. I mean, they are all Aymara Indians and proud of it. And that's supposed to be the best organized city in the world. They have an organization on every single block, and they have community policing. They completely organize themselves. They have community-wide councils, and when something happens that they need to protest, they can mobilize that whole city and come marching down into La Paz. I mean, the airport's up there too, so they have that. So it isn't dangerous, you know, in other parts of the city. There is, you know, in a country with as great a poverty that they have, there is the problem of crime. And again, it's mostly thievery, right? But we have this picture, which is sort of gruesome, but it's common in a neighborhood that's been having trouble with crime in their neighborhood that they'll put a dummy up in the corner of the neighborhood that's hanging by the neck as a warning to thieves that this is what will happen to you if you mess with this neighborhood. But so there is that as well. I think there's a man in the back hasn't spoken.
Yeah, I used to be a Peace Corps volunteer there, so I need your update and joining and all that. I just wondered, is Sendero Luminoso still a factor with Shining Path, or are they not part of what's going on politically there?
Not in Bolivia. I mean, they're a little bit in Peru still.
Yeah, okay.
They were mainly in Peru. There was an attack just recently, but we were in Peru and we asked about that, and they didn't even want to talk about it. I mean, which led me to believe that there was still an element there.
But we met with a number of intellectuals, that like a sociologist in Santa Cruz, and the human rights worker gave us a very good history of a lot of the developments. And one of the things that a number of people talked about was that they, particularly people who are part of the MAS party, the Movement Towards Socialism, which I'd like to talk a little bit about, really, you know, made a decision for democracy over armed struggle, and that they've embraced that. And so that is what they've been really working towards, with Morales running, you know, since 2000, since the water wars. And so that, you know, they really made it, in Bolivia, they really have made that distinction and, you know, and are successful. I mean, just last week they had a march to the capital in La Paz, and the people came down from El Alto. Tens of thousands of people to pressure the Senate, which was holding things up, not unlike this country. Morales has control of the House, but he doesn't have control of the Senate, and they were holding up the referendum for the Constitution, and so they had a number of marches last week where eventually they reached a compromise, which Dave mentioned earlier. They're going to vote on the new Constitution in January. So that was something that was discussed quite often.
Is there still tin mining in Bolivia? And are the tin mines owned by extranational people or the government?
The government owns most of the tin mines. There is still tin mining, but it's just a fraction of what it once was. And there are a couple of mines that are still fairly productive, but they're, you know, they really mined a lot of that out. And then the price of tin dropped in addition to that. The ownership is split between the government and what they call cooperatives. But they aren't really cooperatives as we would think of cooperatives. They are more like small business ventures made up of a group of miners who get paid based on how much they can mine. The government miners are on salary, and this has created some considerable tension among the people, because the government mines have, since the miners get paid a salary regardless of how much they mine, their priority is to preserve the mines and to not mine them out, while the other group wants to mine it as much as they can so they can get money. And this is something they're going to have to resolve, because there's been fighting between those two groups over access to the mines.
Can you just briefly go over, I've heard a number of references to a larger mining industry and the mining oligarchy. Could you briefly review for some of us, like, what came before Morales?
Sure.
Like the last 30 years or so?
I don't know this real well, but I'll tell you what I do know. Prior to in the 1960s and 1970s, tin and to a lesser extent lead and antimony were all mined in this area. Do you have actual facts?
That's it, time.
Oh, yeah, okay, thanks. The mines are pretty much in these two states, Oruhu and Potosi. That's where most of them are. The mines were owned by a small oligarchy with ties to the old regime, ties to Spain. They considered themselves Spaniards. The miners were all Indians. Mining conditions were really terrible. And they organized a union, and there was tremendous amount of struggle, particularly in the 1970s, a huge amount of struggle. And that got very, very violent. There was an instance where when the miners came out of the mine, the oligarchy and their militias just machine gunned them, killed a whole bunch of them just as they came out of the mine. But they fought back. There was a lot of violence during that period. In the 80s, there reached a point where the miners' union had gained some footage in improving conditions to some extent. The conditions were very, very bad still. Price of tin, which was not at this point the main mineral being mined, collapsed on a national scale. And the IMF provisions, the neoliberal position provisions, included really attack on unionism. And eventually the oligarchy simply closed the mines, moved to the Media Luna states, and got big chunks of land. When they did that, hundreds of thousands, you know, somebody said 350,000 workers were displaced, but just absolutely overnight. And many of them went to El Alto. Many of them went to the area near around Cochabamba there, in the eastern part of Cochabamba, and began growing coca. Now, coca, and this is really an important issue, coca is the a crop of which cocaine is made. We know about that. But what isn't well understood here is that coca has a lot of medicinal properties. It's been a medicinal plant that's been in use for 1,000 years. It's grown widely in not only in Colombia and Peru, but Bolivia. Many of the miners began earning their living doing this. Its property, one of its main properties, the two that made it most popular, didn't include cocaine. It was that it helps with altitude. It enables the body to more efficiently absorb oxygen at high altitudes. Everybody uses coca there. It does not get you high. You don't feel anything when you have it. We both engaged widely in it. I mean, we stayed at a Marinol retreat center. They had a huge bowl of coca leaves in the middle of the table. I mean, it's part of the culture and part of life there. And at breakfast every morning, you get a cup of hot water, jam it full of coca leaves to help you through the day. It also suppresses hunger, so miners used it a great deal in the mines because they were in the mines for long hours without anything to eat, and they used coca to suppress hunger. That probably wasn't very good use, but there are many people use it for almost every disease, so there's a real market for it. So that's what a lot of the miners did, is they became coca growers. Evo Morales' family, also Neolita, whose picture we showed you, her family, Apollonia's family, all were coca growers, and they're still coca growers, and Evo is still the president of the Coca Growers Union. They are attempting to control coca. I'm sort of getting off into that because it's another issue. But they are trying to control coca so that it doesn't leave the country as cocaine. And what they do is that coca growers are allotted a certain amount of coca they can grow. And it's when they have it, they put it in huge bales, and it's weighed at the site. They bring it to a site, it gets weighed, it gets a government tag that has its weight on it and designates a particular market it can go to. Then they put it on a truck and take it to this market, designated market, they weigh it again, and there's government there to control what happens to it. That's essentially what they've been trying to do, to prevent more coca being grown than is needed for local consumption.
The coca growers own their own land then?
Yes, they do. They're
mostly Indians that own any land.
Yes, yes. And most of it is grown in some valleys outside of Cochabamba.
Have you ever come across a good model of a country that's built on extraction of minerals or oil or gas or extraction from the ground, developing a full-blown economy? Because most of them never do. They just don't develop the infrastructure, the roads, manufacturing, and agriculture, the land distribution, et cetera, et cetera.
I don't know, Texas.
You know, Texas is still a country.
Yeah. Well, they think it is, yeah.
There was no Tejas.
No, I don't know.
I'm just curious because you're following or not in favor of the IMF development model is, and that's
I do think they need to diversify, and I said that I think it's a problem to be dependent. It isn't though that they haven't developed infrastructure because of that, because there's still not enough to go around. One of the questions that I pondered is how can it be that there's persistent poverty, not only in Bolivia, but throughout South America, particularly among the Indian populations, when there are so many resources around. And I think one thing that I've come up with is just my own opinion is that unlike the U.S., where we had our 13 original colonies that issued a declaration of independence in a unified way and stayed unified, that didn't happen in South America. That the Spanish, when they came in 500 years ago, they established quite a strong administrative system where governors occupied the cities that are now the capitals of most of South America and had their own armies, had very strong situation for them. They were able to suppress the indigenous people and maintain a lot of wealth and a lot of strength. When they kicked the Spanish out 300 years later, at that point, Simon Bolivar, the reason they call him the George Washington of South America, said, okay, we need to do what the United States did, have a United States of South America. That was his vision, and to bring all those resources together. And instead what happened is that the different entities began fighting with one another over territory. They fought for over 100 years, constant wars. So what you end up with was a fragmentation, a balkanization of countries without the ability to pull together, when they need to pull together. I thought, I have a lot of hope, and the reason I stressed those four institutions at the beginning, that maybe the corner has been turned on this to some degree, that they are beginning to unite. And I found it very hopeful that when Evo Morales and later Hugo Chavez threw the U.S. ambassadors out, there was an emergency meeting of UNASUR that was called by Michelle Bachelet, the president of Chile, in Santiago, Chile. And they met to discuss the situation mainly in Bolivia. And every country in South America was there, and they passed a unanimous resolution, including even Colombia, which was the U.S.'s closest ally, who said that Evo Morales was within his rights to throw the U.S. ambassador out. There should not be retaliation for that. And furthermore, the other countries of South America will not tolerate a coup against Evo Morales. That really set the right wing back. They were serious, and they were essentially indicating that if they overthrew him, they were going to have to deal with all of them this time. So I found that extremely hopeful.
So Does the U.S. Embassy in Bolivia have the same long tradition of being an alternate seat of power that that our embassies in Central America have had?
Yes. And I think the reason they threw the ambassador out was that at the very time this right-wing uprising was going, immediately after Evo Morales gets elected by 67% of the vote, the U.S. ambassador, instead of going to the presidential palace and congratulating the president on his victory, goes and meets with the opposition leader. And he said, that does it. You know, that was the greatest disrespect possible. Not only are they giving these guys money, but they very publicly disrespected president of a country that has the support of two-thirds of its people. It's just absolutely unbelievable.
Thank you.
Thank you.